you know, when we're in the same room together, eating off of each other, it's quite remarkable. It's inspiring. It's exciting. It's reassuring.
Hi there, it's WAMC News Director Ian Pickus. And on this episode of the WAMC News Podcast, something special for fans of musicians Matt Sweeney and Will Oldham. We have an extended conversation about the new Super Wolves album. In 2005, Sweeney and Oldham released a critically acclaimed collaborative record called Super Wolf. Sweeney is known for his stints in bands like Chavez and Zwan, as well as his prolific session work that includes contributions to records by Johnny Cash, Neil Diamond, and the band then known as the Dixie Chicks, and Current 93. Oldham, known on stage as Bonnie Prince Billy, is a celebrated singer-songwriter and actor, appearing in films like Old Joy, Julian Donkey Boy, and Jackass 3D. 16 years after their first collaboration, the two have come together again to release another well-received album, this one called Super Wolves. And this month, they're in Tivoli, New York for a residency at the Kotzebue Cultural Park Theater that starts today and runs through December 19th. Calling in from Portland, Oregon and Louisville, Kentucky, Sweeney and Oldham caught up with WAMC Berkshire Bureau Chief Josh Landes before the shows for an extended conversation. Okay, here's Josh.
So as I'm sure you're well aware, Western Massachusetts has like a classic like fall thing of the foliage or what have you. Is there like a Kentucky autumnal thing that's maybe underreported on or something I'm not familiar with?
There's a lot underreported in Kentucky, I think. Well, probably a lot underreported all over the place. There's only so much bandwidth and people, you know, have to watch their streaming shows.
Gotcha.
Beautiful here, though. I don't think we had a, I think fall came and went quickly last year for some strange reason, but normally it's quite lovely.
Do you find yourself particularly in tune to the seasons?
Yeah, I think so. At this point in my life, it's really subconscious, but if I think about it, I'm most definitely in tune with the seasons.
So I had an idea of asking both of you separately how you would describe each other as collaborators, and given that we're still sort of mano a mano right now, no better time to ask. If you were to describe Matt as a collaborator at this point over the decades you've worked together, what comes to mind?
Well, given our very, very present situation, you know, this comes to mind, that I'm here and he's not. But, you know, when we're in the same room together, eating off of each other, it's quite remarkable. It's inspiring. It's exciting. It's reassuring. I find that I can leap off of any point, whether it's in lyrically or in vocal performance, and that he's there to catch me. Yeah, he brings, you know, we complement each other's sensibilities, I believe, musically, and just in our life views. We both have strong senses of musical history. We have strong senses of musical responsibility, but they're just slightly different enough from each other that they complement each other pretty significantly.
Now, the areas where things don't line up, is there the sort of situation where, like, you're in the car with Matt, you throw something on, and it's like, fuck no, veto. Is it that sort of thing, or have you sort of felt out the limits of that?
That pretty much never happens. I think that that never happens. I think any time that we play some music for each other, I think the other person is, the mind of the other person opens wide and is prepared to take in and learn and experience anything that would otherwise be thought of as foreign, for the most part. Matt's also a wonderful supporter and cheerleader of people that he knows, loves, or even likes. And so there are times when he's, you know, really down with music, sometimes because it's, you know, people that he loves. It's situational or circumstantial sometimes more than it is musical. But I think he understands when it comes down to it, when it comes down to the crucial moment of playing music for, you know, like putting it on in the car, that his sense of propriety takes over, and he won't play something that he knows won't stand up musically on its own.
Now, when it comes to the new Superwolves record, are these lyrics that you've developed specifically for this project, or are they things that you've accumulated just in the significant span between recordings that you felt might be sort of, you know, dog-eared for Matt down the road? Tell me about that.
It's a mix of the two things, because I will be working on words fairly consistently, and some of those places, some of those songs just don't find homes, and I don't really pay attention sometimes to the accumulation of potential song lyrics until we were putting this record began with songs that were written specifically for the collaboration. So it began with, I think the first few songs were You Can Regret What You Have Done and Good to My Girls. And I think maybe My Body Is My Own. And those were all things that I worked on specifically to send to Matt. Like, but I knew in writing them that I wouldn't have known what to do with them. They were, you know, that's part of the joy of working with Matt, is that I know, you know, sometimes for myself, I'll build in things that are kind of more obvious because my musical mind is not quite as evolved as his is when it comes to realizing musical ideas. So I'll build in sort of kind of safety net things like a strong chorus or an obvious rhyme scheme or things that I know I can fall back on and say, okay, this is a song. But with Matt, I feel like I can give him something that I might not, that I know is a song, but that musically I couldn't fully realize its songness without him.
Now, in preparation for this tour on the new record, are you sort of looking forward to presenting the work that's on the record, or is there a larger body of not just collaborative songs from the first record, but, you know, given that you're both you both cover all kinds of stuff on the records in your personal careers, is there sort of like a songbook for the Superwolves road tour? Is it largely sticking to the records? Walk me through that.
It's sticking to the records. I feel like we have a handful of other songs. There's a song during lockdown last year, I guess, even though it seems, I don't even know what a year is anymore. Last year during lockdown, Bill Callahan and I released a series of songs to sort of provide succor to everyone suffering under the limitations of lockdown. And we chose songs to cover in collaboration with numerous other musical artists, including Matt. And with Matt, we did a version of Hank Williams Jr.'s classic song, OD'd in Denver. And so we had so much fun making that we've put that into the set. There's a song by a woman named Joan Shelley, who's a Kentucky songwriter, called Stay on My Shore that we recorded, and we've been playing that in the set as well. We've talked about playing a Mekon song. We might play a Mekon song. And then we may, you know, write more songs. And then there's a number of kind of odd tracks here and there that we have recorded and released, maybe, you know, on a soundtrack or a compilation or a single that may make its way into the set.
So I wanted to ask you about the naming convention of the two records. I'm a big fan of, you know, long, sloppy movie franchises where naming conventions get stranger or cleverer over time. I'm delighted by Superwolf to Superwolves. Walk me through that. How much thought went into that? Because it's the sort of detail that someone like me, a depraved nerd, is takes great delight in.
Well, the word or phrase, however you want to look at it, Superwolf, came from, you know, dead center of one of the songs from the first record. And in looking at this, we thought, you know, should we dig into the lyrics? Should we get outside of the lyrics? And then we threw around ideas of, I think another idea that was that we would call it super wolfing, which is usually the verb that we use to describe what we do when we're together. But it came down finally to, as you say, sort of a tribute to the Alien franchise specifically, because that was Alien and then Aliens, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's that story of James Cameron walking into the whatever studio produced it and writing Alien with a dollar sign after it.
Ah, I didn't know that story.
Yeah, he nailed that one. All right, so you're a fan of the Alien movies?
Yeah, I am a fan of the Alien movies. I think Alien, I can't remember if Alien or a revival screening of MASH was my first R-rated movie, but it was one of those two movies. When I was a kid at the, I remember seeing it, you know, as a kid, of course, getting a big crush on Sigourney Weaver. And when I was about, I don't know, what year did Alien come out? Maybe 80, something like that, 79, 80, 81?
Let me take a look here really quick. What? The original came out in the year 1979.
79. So when I was 13, I used to do a lot of acting in my childhood and teens, and there's a theater here called the Actors Theater of Louisville that has every year a new play festival of new American plays, and I was in one back in 1983 called Food from Trash by a playwright named Gary Leon Hill, and it used to be a festival that drew luminaries from the film and theater world, kind of from all over the world, critics and writers and directors and actors. And I remember in 83 when I was in Food from Trash that Sigourney Weaver came, and, you know, my mind was, of course, absolutely blown to be standing in the same room as Sigourney Weaver here in Louisville, Kentucky.
It's such a story of isolation and fear, and I mean, your work deals with a lot of those themes, it sounds like. So, I mean, how deep does the Alien thing go?
Well, and similarly, it deals with isolation and fear. And, you know, as I got older and could pick apart the cast of especially the original Alien and see, you know, Harry Dean Stanton and Ian Holm and John Hurt and Yaphet Kotto and, you know, realize and learn something about the power of ensemble acting and the power of bringing a group of insanely inspired and talented individuals together to make something, you know, greater. So that it wasn't, I think that's one of the things that made that such a rewarding and wonderful movie, is because it, you know, these people brought such depth and complexity and humanity to the situation that it definitely was not a simple story.
When we last talked in 2018, you talked about your love of the band Bitchin' Bajas from Chicago. I've had the opportunity to dive more into their work over the last few years. Your music is often very grounded in, you know, a lot of acoustic instrumentation, a lot of roots music, a lot of songwriting-oriented material. They're a band that sort of has this drifty, cosmic, cosmiche approach to exploring sound in what seems like a different manner. I'm interested in how you relate to them and what they're working on and what it was like working with them on Epic Jammers and Fortunate Little Ditties.
Yeah, we came together because Dan Koretsky at Drag City recognized a similar way of approaching the work of music. So yeah, anyway, Matt says he's calling in now. So that's kind of part of our dynamic, is that he doesn't always know what's going on, and it's kind of exhausting sometimes. So yeah, Bitchin' Bajas, it seems like they look at life and music and travel in a similar way that I do, which is not a way that I share with a lot of people. I don't know a lot of musicians, performers who look at, I don't know, who just kind of look at the adventure of travel and the adventure of making music, you know, as the continuity of creation and exploration in the same way. And so when we were together, whenever we've worked together, it's just kind of been, it's a natural fit, a far more natural fit than with a lot of people that you might think would be, you know, from a distance, you might say, oh, well, putting Will together in the room with this person makes a lot of sense. And usually it doesn't, because making music is very objective and personal and complicated. So it's only with there's a lot of boxes to be checked in order to really find creative common ground. And working with them was just insanely natural. When we made that record, Epic Dammer's Unfortunate Little Ditties, I think they were coming through town. We knew we were going to do something together. I had bought a old reel-to-reel recording machine for another project, and I never used it, and it was sitting on the ground. And they came into my house, saw the reel-to-reel over in the corner. Cooper started hooking up his gear, his board to it. Other instruments were set up, and within 30 minutes of their arriving in town, arriving in our house, we were recording a record of, you know, material that we'd never heard or played before. And it was, you know, it couldn't have been more natural. It couldn't have been more fun, really.
Well, and you got to take that on the road.
Matt's saying the passcode won't work. I don't know.
Oh, interesting. It seemed to work for you.
It worked for me, yes.
Yeah, that's odd. Is he hitting pound afterward?
I don't know, man.
While I've got you on the line, I'm so fascinated. I'm a huge fan of Masaki Bato, and the fact that you got to hook up with Bato in Japan with Bitchin' Bajas, that just seems so wild. He's such a incredible musician and such a cosmic dude. I saw him do his Brain Waves set in New York City once. He's always one step ahead of everybody. What was that like working with Masaki?
It was fantastic. It's funny, the thing with Callahan and I, the series of songs, the only two people that we approached to work on who ultimately declined were Bato and Jim O'Rourke, and both of those guys demonstrated their willingness and ability to collaborate because they both joined Bitchin' Bajas and myself on stage in Tokyo for different sets when we were there, and were incredible, were awesome. But Bato, I think I first met him in the, I think it was the late 90s. Ghost was touring, and my younger brother was running sound for them, and David Pajo and I just sort of traveled as groupies watching the shows, and I think we had a DAT recorder, and we recorded the shows. And then I think we may have played a show with them maybe in Seattle, because it helped them get the show to have these American acts playing with them. But yeah, he's one of those people that when he's in the music, he is music personified. And when he does his Brain Pulse music is, of course, the greatest and most undeniable of examples, because he's right there. And, you know, the music is just ostensibly coming from his brain directly to our ears. But really, whenever he's playing or singing, performing, he's so consumed by what he's doing musically that you couldn't, you know, you couldn't separate the music from the human. And he's charming and wonderful to spend time with. That was an insanely rewarding set there in Tokyo with Bato.
So looking at this forthcoming record that you and Bill Callahan are putting out in December, you cover all sorts of material with all sorts of guests. One of the tracks looks like, you know, you, Bill, and Ben from Six Organs of Admittance doing your own song, Arise Therefore. What was it like to revisit that song?
Yeah. Well, when Bill Callahan and I, you know, we were doing the Matt's saying the passcode is being, he's being told it's invalid. When Bill and I, we were coming up with the song list, part of the assignment was we each had to come up with a song of the other person's that we would take the lead on as sort of the lead singer, lead voice. And so Bill chose Arise Therefore. And I think we toured together around the time that Arise Therefore came out. And I think it just holds a significant place in his memory brain. And Chasney was assigned to the song randomly. Everybody was assigned their songs randomly. And Chasney first came up with something apparently that sounded a lot like the Arise Therefore record. And Bill confronted him and said, no, rip it apart. And so he ripped it apart and gave us that. And so I didn't hear it until Ben and Bill had done most of their dirty work onto it. And for me, then it was a joy. You know, once the song is, you know, as I'm writing a song, I'm kind of, you know, at each step, it's kind of preparing the song to be taken over. It's like an, you know, it's like an assembly line in some levels. There's different layers of the creation of the text and the original song, and then there's recording, and then beyond that there's performing. And at each point, you kind of don't look at the future of the song or the past of the song. You look at the present of the song. And in this case, the present of the song was that it was delivered to me, fully realized by Chasney and Callahan. And all I got to do or had to do was to join in on the chorus and add some synth parts, and just treat it like, you know, just treat it like any other song. Just, what does this song, what can I potentially add to it? Where can it go? You know, where is it coming from? And it didn't feel like, quote unquote, my song. It was our song at that point.
What was it like approaching?
I just joined.
Oh, fantastic.
Hi.
Hey.
Sorry. I was just listening. Go ahead.
Yeah. Welcome to the party, so to speak. Just to sort of to level things off here, Matt, before you called on, I had asked Will to describe you as a collaborator, and I'm interested in flipping it to you and asking you if you were to describe Will as a collaborator across these many years, what are the words or concepts that come to mind?
Well, before I get to that, I wanted to know what Will was talking about with Ben Chasney. What song was that you all were talking about?
Arise for on the thing with Callahan.
Oh, right. Oh, cool.
Yeah.
We just I'm here in Portland. We listened to the new to the latest Will and Bill Callahan track yesterday morning. It sounded really cool.
Right on.
Yeah. Oh, so what is it like to collaborate with Will? That's the question. It's really fun. It's like one of my favorite things. It's, you know, it's kind of like my favorite musical challenge, because I don't think that there's anybody who can sort of bounce the ball back in a more, or who can serve or bounce a ball back in a way that I find more interesting or challenging than Will. I suppose what it's like to collaborate with him would be like, yeah, imagine somebody who, whatever you're going to do with them, you don't know how it's going to be, but you know that they're going to give it their all, and that you could be confident in whatever. I don't know. I always feel like I'm confident that what I react to or offer will be considered and reacted to in a really, really full way, in a very full and intense way.
When it comes to putting together material for your ongoing collaboration, is this the kind of thing where you're woodshedding stuff over the years, where you're like, well, this is going to work well with Will, or would you sort of hit the ground running with the new project when it started to come together? What's the story there?
It's this and that. There's definitely some things that I'll have that I'll make up that I'll just sort of put aside because I'll think that they're good. And generally, if I have sort of random ideas that I think are strong, I often do sort of save them for Super Wolves, just because, I don't know, because I generally think that my strongest stuff ends up sounding the strongest in that format. But then other times it's really different every time. Sometimes it'll be from out of the blue, and other times, you know, like I'll be inspired by something that Will wrote, and then other times it could be that that there's something that I've had waiting that I'm hoping maybe could be used. It's really all over the place.
So, you know, I'm interested, as you guys get ready to hit the road again around this record, what's the sort of day-to-day look like with you two on the road? How do you prepare for it? Do you have, you know, sort of talismans or, you know, a tube of zinc drops? Or what do you sort of have in your back pocket for hitting the road in 2021?
Yeah, that's a good question. Will, you have any plans?
I think since COVID started, I've always had cloves of raw garlic in my pocket. Chew on.
That's
a big one.
Yeah.
Matt likes to go running every day.
Yeah. So I'll bring my shoes. I was thinking about how last night, how it's interesting that, or I guess I'm glad that I'm older and that I can think of a show sometimes as an opportunity to kind of perform as best, you know, like to kind of take everything that I've learned in my life and perform and see what that's like. And that's a pretty cool challenge. Whereas before, part of the appeal of touring was basically to experience all the things that COVID doesn't allow, you know what I mean? Like to breathe the same air as other people, or to be around people that I've never met before and do all these things. So I was just thinking last night about how, with going on the road, what's going to change and what, you know what I mean? Like are the things that I use, the kind of random things that I used to really look forward to, meaning, again, chance encounters and unexpected things, are all kind of out the window for the next couple of years, it seems. So as far as what I'm planning on bringing on the road, I don't know. Guitar strings, a scarf, it's going to be cold, you know?
Yeah, it's going to be cold.
So again, Matt, before you got here, I was talking to Will about the naming convention of Super Wolf to Super Wolves, and he mentioned that it was in some ways an homage to Alien to Aliens. And, you know, you guys are roughly the same age. You've got a lot of cultural reference points in common. Is that something that contributes to your collaboration, the fact that you've sort of grown up with a lot of the same touchstones?
I'd definitely say so, wouldn't you, Will?
I would, yeah. There's probably just enough that we have in common and just enough that we can, you know, consistently inform and surprise the other one with. So yeah, it's a nice balance. We don't get bored of saying, hey, did you know, just turning each other on to things from throughout our lives, because there's so much that we don't have in common, but we have a common language that's huge and significant that allows us, you know, the freedom to communicate fully about all these things.
Yeah, that I'd say that's well said, in that we seem to enjoy, we like loads of different stuff, but we definitely seem to be able to describe why and how we enjoy them, and we seem to feel things in a way that I got somehow in a similar way, which was kind of established early on. So yeah, so it's cool because, again, it's similar to the collaborative thing. I do not know what Will is going to say or turn me on to next, but I know that it's going to be something that's going to land, and something that I'm going to, that I will understand or have the ability to understand. Yeah, which is cool. I think it's neat to be able to communicate with the person who has such a broad lead, who has very, very different interests, but then can bring those interests to you and show you what they are, you know, and allow you to engage with them, in them, as opposed to like being like, oh yeah, you know, we both like the Dallas Cowboys, you know, and then endlessly talking about the Dallas Cowboys. I don't know why I thought of them.
So you're not a Dallas Cowboys fan.
Exactly. It's just like, you know, this is something I don't care about at fucking all.
I was a big fan of the Dallas Cowboys products that the Sears catalog sold in the 1970s, like sweatshirts and bathrobes for children. Yeah, I don't think I ever watched I don't think I've ever watched the Dallas Cowboys play, but a game of football. But they were my favorite football team when I was a child, simply based on the fact that they had a blue star and silver.
And then you see, this is a good example, because similarly, I wasn't interested in watching the teams play, but I was super into their uniforms, and I would draw their uniforms all the time. And I think I liked drawing the Bengals because they had tiger stripes on their helmet.
Right on.
Yeah.
If there was to be a Super Wolves jersey, would it be a football jersey?
That's a good question.
That's a great question.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe
we should make one.
I know that
the football players still wear those like perforated jerseys. Is that still a standard jersey? I remember those from when we were kids. They were kind of nylon with holes all over them.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
We should totally make one of those.
That would be good. I'd also be into wearing, just because I like, And I know that Will also can rock a sleeveless. I don't follow basketball, but I thought a basketball jersey, or with your question, it makes me think that a basketball jersey could be nice as well. Something sleeveless for the summer with little holes in it could be good. A football and a basketball jersey, I'm in.
One of the best parts of the return to touring for me as a journalist is I get to talk to a lot of musicians again. And I just earlier this week had the opportunity to talk to Bill Payne of Little Feat, who's one of these, you know, guys who his session career is so fascinating. And hearing him talk about playing with Nilsson and playing with B.B. King and playing with Ringo Starr. Yeah, I mean, he's got a million stories. But Matt, you're something of a session guy yourself. And I'm interested in your experience of, you know, it sounds like your collaboration with Will is very one-to-one. And I'm sure there's a lot of times where you're sort of working around someone else's vision. So can you walk me through some of your experiences of being a session guy and how that contrasts with something like Super Wolves?
Well, you just said it. You just said it. General, or you know, with Super Wolf, it's a thing where it's a one to one thing. When you're if somebody's asked you to play on their record, then it is about seeing their particular vision through in a way where you know you want to be there to make something sound good, and maybe you know, like I guess if I'm working with somebody that isn't Will, maybe sometimes you want to surprise them and push them a little bit, but. Definitely less so, because this person has probably already thought a lot about what they want out of you. I don't know. It really is different every time, but I'm thinking right now because I'm making a record right now where I didn't write any of the songs. So, yeah, that's kind of what I'll do is sort of either try – if the person knows what they want, then I'll do that. Or if they don't know what they want, which is usually rarer, then I'll try to come up with something that I think is really interesting and that will maybe make them excited.
Well, it's just amazing to look through, like, you know, I think you may be the one person who can complete the single degree of separation from the Dixie Chicks to Current 93, for example. Like, that strikes me as a pretty varied experience in this kind of work.
Yeah, Current 93 was more fun, for sure. in that case, that was interesting. With the Dixie Chicks, I was sort of brought in. They had been working on a record, and the producer told them, oh, this guy's really good. So, you know, and then I was like, okay, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. And I ended up playing some finger-picky part for them and then did some stuff. Whereas with Current 93, that actually was, unfortunately, wasn't in person. I mean, yeah, it really is funny. Because I never really was that good about being in the studio. I think even in my 20s, and it's funny that I've had so many studio experiences, but yeah, I don't know. I'm lucky to be able to do it. And I guess it's something that I thought I wouldn't be good at. And I'm surprised that I can play well with others, because I used to have such a hard time with that growing up. So it really was a surprise. And I credit Will with, in some ways, sort of opening up my idea of how to play with somebody and how to make music with somebody and respect what they're doing and sort of respect what their voice is and how to sort of build something around that or build a frame around a voice or a song that could in some way make it more fun to listen to or drive a point home better. Playing with somebody who sings like and writes songs like Will can teach you a lot.
I'm interested about your experiences working closer to the major label world. Obviously, Will, that's something you've worked to avoid over your time, and Matt, you've brushed up on it throughout your career. Is that something you guys talk about or compare experiences with?
I don't know. I don't think we have. Yeah. No, I don't think we've ever talked about it. My understanding is that it is more disorganized than ever and isn't necessarily much of a thing.
Yeah, mine too.
I don't know.
Yeah. I was just
doing some street legal research, Matt, and that record in 1978 was recorded like at the end of April, over 4 days at the end of April, beginning of May, and then released in mid-June.
Jesus.
On a major label.
That's insane.
It's totally insane.
How is that? I don't see how that's even possible.
We're told that it's not possible now by even independent labels. But obviously they could, you know, motivate and put out, you know, a record that I'm sure that they had some degree of hope for, because I think Desire had come before that and it was a successful record.
Right.
Crazy. It's crazy. Like that was when music, which it really become again with streaming, unfortunately, that was when music, you know, had a relationship to current culture, when mass media had a relationship to current culture, which it is, right, which right. it just can't anymore.
Well, yeah. It's funny you mention that. In my own casual research into street legal, they talk about how Dylan, when he found out that Elvis had died while making the record, he says he basically stopped doing anything for a week and didn't talk to anybody for a week. So that mass media, that mass culture certainly seemed to imprint itself on some part of that process.
Well, yeah, and then that weird back cover picture, which seems to be a reaction to Elvis and also like a strange reaction in the moment. You know, maybe, you know, like that with him looking like Fat Elvis and looking strange and just all of that.
Because, you know, Elvis died during the writing of that record. And the bass player in the band on the record was Elvis's bass player during the TCB phase.
I just found out that Elvis's drummer was Jerry Garcia Band's drummer.
Yeah, Ron Tutt. The great Ron Tutt.
Who just passed away. But his gigs were, at one point, he would go from Elvis to Neil Diamond to Jerry Garcia. That was like his.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
And you've now recorded with one of those guys, right?
I have recorded with Neil Diamond, and he was just the fucking coolest. I've seen that drummer and Neil Diamond play together. Neil Diamond was very deferential to him, made a big deal about him, and you know, told Madison Square Garden all about him. It was really cool. I guess Neil Diamond has written this or given co-writing credit to every member of his long-standing band, which is really cool, I think. His band loves him. It was really fun seeing him play because, you know, all those guys are paid.
That's awesome. You know, Will obviously has made a big part of his career interpreting the works of, you know, iconic singer-songwriters and delving into the body of work of the Everly Brothers. The list is quite long at this point. You know, if you guys were to, and you do covers, obviously, in your collaboration, if you were ever to agree on one songwriter to work on a whole exploration of, who would that be? You both sound like dyed-in-the-wool Dylan fans, certainly an easy pick maybe, but what comes to mind?
Gee, good question. Shit.
I didn't mean to come off as sounding like a dyed-in-the-wool Dylan fan. We were just talking about one record over the course of a 50-plus year career. Potentially Phil Lynott?
Yeah, that's a great call. Actually, that was what was in the back of my mind, but I couldn't think of it.
Just in terms of somebody that we have spent hours and hours listening to and talking about, and you know, that would be fun for both Matt and I to dig into, because he was an exceptional lyricist, vocalist, and musical songwriter.
Yeah, I just watched a Phil Lynott doc that was, I'll find out what it is, Will, and I'll send it to you. I can't remember the name of it, but it was like a BBC thing, and there was, you know, it was middling on some level as far as a piece of film. But again, I couldn't stop watching it because it's so fucking incredible. It is incredible. There's lots of amazing performances that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah, please.
And I found myself. I found myself just completely in awe of Phil Lynott. Like, just you know, he would easily be a guy who that would be a great one, I would say.
Yeah,
because there's no end to the lyrics. There's no end to how he sings. You know, like there's.
The Irish tour to support the record would be insanely fun.
That would be fucking amazing. That's a really good idea.
Like every show would be so much fun. Yeah.
Oh my god! And then all these Irish people showing up, all like they would know every single song.
They would know every song, every word.
They would know exactly how we're fucking with it.
Yeah.
That's cool. Oh, my God. So he's one for sure. It's funny because so many really great artists are like, you know, some of them are untouchable. Like me and Will were talking about Michael Hurley the other day, or somebody had suggested doing a Michael Hurley cover. And it's kind of sometimes for me, that one's, I would rather cover Phil Lynott than Michael Hurley. I don't know why.
Yeah, Hurley would be hard. I mean, another person that comes to mind that might be that we might be too close to, but I think if we, you know, in a few years wrapped our head around the idea, it could be kind of insane, would be a Sean Marshall record.
Of her songs?
Of her songs, where you and I do her songs. Yeah.
That's a good idea. That's funny.
And if Ferg hadn't already done it, I would say a Cowboy Jack Clement record. But
yes,
there's no need to do that.
Yeah. It could be interesting to do, and I think I did think about this. I mean, there's not a burning need, but Cowboy's got so many, all those cool songs that nobody's ever heard. That would be a fun one. But yes, he's been, Ferg's treatment of him will stand for a while. Yeah, those are all good ideas. It's funny, Malcolm has just brought up the other day about how he feels like there's Sean Marshall records that haven't been made yet. That would be great.
Yeah, we might have to make them. I don't know if she's going to.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. It's interesting how covers and the way that say someone like Will has approached covers, you know, which is to say sort of doing it, being adventurous and messing with them and fucking with them has become a lot more common, it seems. Or maybe common is not the right word, but more people do it, you know.
Is that right? Because someone was talking,
I feel like
to somebody
it.
About the new like Metallica record, which is some sort of cover
right.
of one of their records, and they said that's perfectly like it's like note for note. It just sounds like somebody made a you know a mall karaoke record
version
of it.
So it's Metallica covering their own songs,
but maybe lots of people lots of like famous people covering their songs also.
Oh,
but they're
right.
all covering
yeah,
them
I
just
think I,
just like. Just as if they were recording for a karaoke company. Yeah.
Well, Taylor Swift famously, of course, is re-recording much of
right.
her back catalog. What are your thoughts on that? I
right.
mean, Will, you certainly have revisited a lot of your own work in different formats. What are your thoughts on seeing this play out in such an unbelievably commercially successful way in the mainstream?
The two things I really like about it, one is have you seen, Matt, the I guess maybe they're releasing some of the things on 45 RPM 12-inch records and vinyl buyers who are not familiar with the fact that there is more than one speed you can play a record at are confused and demanding their money back because they're playing a record and they're like, this is a man singing these songs. So that's one thing that
that's
I like about
awesome.
The fact that she's doing that.
I'd
the other
that.
The other thing is of course, Taylor Swift, she is doing, I think, a fairly wonderful job in terms of informing the public a little bit about some of the things, some of the ways in which we do what we do and just by she's re-recording them for a reason, and it's a business reason. But she's taking it, you know, she's blurring the lines between creativity and business, which is something that we all do. And I don't think that it's been clear enough to audiences that this is, you know, that it's the music business that we're involved with, and therefore most people say, well, music should be free, and that's led to the rise of this, you know. What's the word? Parasitic music industry practice of streaming songs.
Mm-hmm.
But Taylor Swift does a pretty good job of letting millions of people know just some of the how the sausage is made in the music business and saying I'm doing this because I want to own masters because the contracts under which I was working were not 100% fair before. And she does a number of things that help to reveal some of the nuts and bolts of what we do to the audience at large, which I think is really helpful.
That just sort of reminds me of why I like that Cocaine and Rhinestones podcast, particularly this season, is they do, as he talks about, actually I guess he talks about it a lot, just this whole, I think he really makes it exciting or interesting that a lot of creative things happen for 100% business reasons. In music,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And a lot of like mysteries and weird things become, you know, it's like, oh, so that really strange thing was because, or that song that sounds, you know, that's excited me. So for all these weird reasons happened because of something that I would have never imagined, which is some weird business
yeah.
reason. And
yeah.
to me, that's like, oh, that's fucking cool. As opposed to like,
yeah,
that's not disappointing at all, you know?
Yeah, in general, professional musicians have done too good a job at making invisible the means of production,
yeah.
I think. Yeah,
totally, totally. That's funny. That's another thing I've been thinking about, just making this. I think maybe I'm sensitive. I've been in Portland very leisurely and comfortably making a record, and it's been stress-free and very, very fun. But has allowed me to think about the record making process and, you know, just how specific it is, and that there are all of these real things that happen that are worky, practical things that are like, you know, that are part of the sausage that are, like, sort of have to happen. And they're really, I don't know how to put it, but it's like, yeah, this is how you make a record. This happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, and it has to happen this way. And it can be very, very organized, you know, and the result is something that's mind-blowing and, or ideally mind-blowing, and you can't put into words, you know, but there are these, as artists, we sort of, the ideal sort of seems to have been like to hide certain things about the process. And I guess I like all of it. I think all of it's neat.
Yeah, I'm so interested in that because you're sort of talking about like a means of production revelation about this sort of shadowy process. I'm interested in sort of the more whimsical note. You know, you guys are in this position where there's this tremendous middle part, this tremendous process where I imagine you have to have a lot of faith in the end product. On the two records you've done together, how much of it was sort of, oh, this is fucking gold, and how much of it was, well, when it's all together, we're going to see the full forest with the trees? What was that process like working together?
Well, it's a big windup, isn't it? I mean, Will, like, you know, there's a lot of work outside of the studio, tons, you know, over a long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess I was also thinking of that in relation to this record that I'm making, which I feel is, you know, I'm having a blast making this record, and it's really different because it's chilled out and it's fun and it's moving along at a you could just see the thing rolling. This is this project I'm working on right now. Whereas with what happens with Superwolves, it is, you know, it's really disparate and I take forever on the songs and there's back and forth and there's emails and then we get together and then we work on the songs really intimately and then we play them live. So by the time that we go into the studio, we actually get it done really, really quickly, but there's been a shit ton of preparation for that. Or this is how the last record happened, I guess. You know, there's been a shit ton of preparation for it, and so it's sort of like we're capturing these performances that have been worked on. There's a really specific energy to it that I think it comes across in the record. You know, like to me that, like, I guess I was just thinking, I was like, oh, you know, we recorded a mix of the songs pretty quickly, you know, like by certainly by rock standards, pretty quickly, but they felt, you know, it felt like it didn't feel like it was really quick, I guess, you know, it didn't feel rushed at all. It was the way that we did it, exactly the way that we wanted to do it. But I guess maybe our process is like a lot of preparation and then really performing in the studio, you know, and like. Again, just like letting it fly because it's fucking ready to go, as opposed to
it's like a professional boxing match or like the consummation of a marriage after, you know, after a significant amount of courtship.
Courting.
And yeah, there's all this circling the event, and then when the event happens, it's you know, brief and glorious, but we've put so much thought and work into it, and preparation of our minds and bodies into doing it, knowing that it's going to be that way, that there's going to be this kind of urgency where we need to be fully present and realizing all of the things that we've kind of been imagining up to that point. It's like a, you know, or like a runner who can run and run and run and then gets their best, you know, their personal best record time when they do actually do the event and maybe doesn't repeat that before or afterwards.
Yeah. Which is a really, you know, fucking cool way to make a record, I think. But again, you know, like you got to really be able to work well with the people that you're doing with for it to be that way, I think.
We're speaking now basically a month before this little residency in upstate New York. When you look at like something like this, mm-hmm. where you're going to be at one spot for a few days, how do you conceptualize what you're going to present to folks? Is this going to be sort of out of the ordinary, given that you're sort of marinating in the vibe, so to speak? Or how are you guys conceptualizing the shows at this point?
We have, Josh, we have some wonderful experience. Like, we started playing shows in June. I think it was June. Like, and you know, when we began right away with our
dear friend and colleague Emmett Kelly joining the ensemble, and then quickly Dave Pajo joined us. And we've done a number of shows now since we finished making this record. We've done some things that's just Matt and me, and some that's Matt and Emmett and me, and some that's all of us, including Pajo. And this is going to be all including Pajo. We're going to go to San Francisco first and rehearse and play a show, and then we'll go to New York. So one of the things that I, you know, look forward to is that we won't really know the answer to your question until it's happening, you know, until we're going to know more tomorrow. We're going to know more in San Francisco, and we're going to know more, you know, when we're rehearsing in Manhattan, what it's going to be like. But, you know, the hope, I think, for all of us is that it will carry over a lot of the strengths from the experiences we've had so far this year and present us with some new unpredicted and unpredictable adventures.
Yeah, agreed.
So what's on both of your fall playlists? How are you guys celebrating autumn musically in your own listening habits?
That's a good question, because I'm in fucking Portland, and Mississippi Records is here, and I was lucky enough to go and buy a stack of records from them, and have been listening to them here, autumn in Portland. So I'm standing over these records that I've been particularly enjoying because of the time and the place. And so this Blind Al Wilson, the singer from Canned Heat, it's a compilation of his stuff. It's fucking amazing. I listened to Dead Moon this morning, and last night I found myself once again just being fucking in awe of them, and that's certainly really good autumnal stuff. He's got brother Theotis Taylor, who's this gospel singer. It's fucking unbelievable. All of that stuff felt very good and autumny to me. Oh, and O.V. Wright. I was listening to him yesterday morning. That sounded really good. So
I love O.V. Wright.
Oh, my God.
Who was the O.V. Wright? Did you get that at Mississippi?
Hell yeah. And it's such a cool... A Nickel and a Nail is on here, also Ace of Spades. That's the name of the title. And I'll send you the... I'll take a picture of it and send you the artwork, because it's really cool. But it's a double record and a 7-inch of sounds of all Memphis, you know, Willie Mitchell stuff. It's really, really good. It's super good. Yeah, that's been my shit.
I got a new phone from Tim Cook's company, and whenever I plug in a headset like I did for this call, it starts playing music right away, and 4 out of 5 times it plays Lou Reed's Take No Prisoners. And I don't know why. Why does it do that? I don't know. I plug in the headphones, and it starts playing music, and the record cover comes up. But I've never bought that on a virtual format, I don't believe. But, you know, it's not a bad thing to see and hear, but it's a strange thing.
I would have John, for a long time, John Prine Live that would happen, and John Prine Live would come up. And the song about the car.
I own both John Prine Live and Lou Reed Take No Prisoners on double cassette back in the 1980s. Maybe it's live,
yeah,
double cassette record.
Yeah, they figured out. They know that about you. They're streaming it. But yeah, every time
there's a new bitch in Bajas doing Sun Ra, called Hooked on Ra, I think, or Switched on Ra, as well as a new Super Crane and Bill McKay cassette that's out. That's really good.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that.
Friends turned me on to Simply Saucer.
So good.
Cyborgs Revisited.
So good. So good.
And then we got from the library the soundtrack to Walt Disney's Moana, and there's an extra bonus disc of songs that weren't in the movie, and we've been listening to a lot of that. And we just started listening to I Know an Old Woman Who Swallowed a Fly, as featured in animated short presented by the National Film Board of Canada, that's on YouTube.
Paying
close attention to that.
So it sounds like you're taking to fatherhood effortlessly.
Right.
Effortlessly. Oh, yeah. Fun. Couldn't be easier.
Will, I got to play it when we're in New York. I guess I bought a CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Company, Native American, like 7-inch of Native American music, all the music that's on that great compilation, Native North American. And it's a four or five song 7-inch, and it's going to blow your mind.
Oh, cool.
Really, really.
Excellent.
So cool. Kind of sound, I mean, actually sounds like, I mean, it's very old of me sounding. You'll see what I mean, as far as like arrangements and stuff. It's really cool.
And then when are the recordings from?
I can't tell. It sounds like early 70s, yeah. I guess.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So banging. Wonderful. But like, you know, a little more pop, or like they're songy and hooky. It's so cool. Really, really cool.
You've got shows booked into next year. You took a considerable break between album one and album two. Looking into the future beyond just the run of shows you have coming up, what are your aspirations for Superwolves? Or is this something that sort of works best as a organic entity?
Oh, man. Let me talking about next year, Matt, there's something.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, I think that there's some basis of truth in this. But so something that I learned in Tulsa, I met some folks who are going to come at least to the Albuquerque show with Sleep.
Uh-huh.
And I was told by these dudes in Tulsa that, well, and I think what is true is that more than any other audience that you and I have ever performed for together, at least, there will be a more, you know, coming off of something you were just talking about, there will be a greater proportion of Native American audience members in our audience than we've ever experienced before.
Because they're Sleep like fans?
Yeah, because they're Sleep fans.
Oh, cool.
Sleep fans in that part of the country are it's going to be...
It's a thing.
These dudes were saying like, oh, yeah, 80% of your audience is going to be... I don't know if that's true, but
I think there's good reason to believe that. I spent a couple tours with the band Full of Hell, the death metal band, and the uh-huh. scene in Albuquerque is extremely passionate. We played down the street from like a casualty show or something, and it was like a huge mm-hmm. group of like, you know, young Native American kids, really passionate musical community. There's even a great grindcore awesome. Band called Laughing Dog from New Mexico who are all Native dudes. And yeah, it's a really, it's an awesome town to play.
Whoa.
Yeah, I like playing there, but this will be, you know, because of Sleep, because we're going to play three shows with Sleep, we're going to be playing for people, yeah, that we would never have, you know, or it would have taken us a much longer time to get to the ears of these people. And so this is going to be kind of rad.
Yeah.
That'll help us understand what the future of Superwolves is, each of these, you know, upcoming experiences that we have together and separately.
Yeah, like we really like to do it. We both also generally agree on what we don't like to do, and we're both also really open to seeing, for example, the Sleep thing being a perfect example of this, is which is, you know, Will hit me up. He's like, what do you think about playing with Sleep? I was like, they're asking? Yeah. Okay, that audience might hate us. Great, let's go. You know what I mean? Like because that's...
Yeah.
You know, like, I definitely want to... I would love to see where the Superwolves... where we can be effective, you know, as performers and, you know, as a musical entity, and finding the place where we want to be or, you know, because... I still believe it, that there's just always weird opportunities to do cool music. Maybe now more than ever. I don't know. You know, like, we'll see. But like
more than ever, simply because we've been on this earth longer and longer. And so we have access to more.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, 100%. That's why. Yeah. For that reason. So. Again, it's compelling for me. It's interesting. It's like something to look forward to, and I don't know exactly what it is. But it's a positive feeling. It's like, cool. Let's see what the fuck we can do. You know,
are you guys prepared to be heckled by metalheads? Is that something you're emotionally and artistically prepared for?
Oh yeah,
I mean, I've long lamented the lack of quality heckling in my musical career. And I, you know, as somebody who loves to heckle, you know, the more well known I am, the more repressed I feel, because I know that I can't go to a show and heckle anymore, because people will be like, "Oh, that's Will Oldham. He's an asshole." Heckling. Where I think heckling is a valid creative exchange.
Well, so what's
most people are afraid to do it. But most people are afraid to do everything. You know, that's why everyone during lockdown was completely locked down, just because everybody's afraid of doing anything. I was on a plane the other day, and there was a guy who came on the plane. He was totally wasted and was smoking. Literally everybody on the plane had a story about a negative encounter with this guy prior to getting onto the plane. And everybody was kind of looking at each other like, and it was a packed flight. What do we do? And finally, I just turned to a stewardess and was like, "Come here. That guy's messed up, and he's going to cause trouble for everybody on this plane once this takes off, if you let him." And that led to him being expelled from the plane. But, you know, I didn't even have the worst experiences with him, but everybody was telling me about their terrible experiences with this guy. And they're just too meek to do anything. That's how... So yeah, hopefully these hecklers will have some cojones and you know, tell us what's what.
I wanted to just ask, while we're on the topic, and Matt, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this as well. But Will, given your spirited defense of the virtues of heckling, what is the Will Oldham artistic guide to being a good heckler?
Good question.
A good heckler, you know, hopes for, you know, an equal and opposite reaction to the action of the heckle, and is listening and paying attention, and is, you know, the heckle is driven by the desire to fully get one's time and money's worth out of the experience.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's meant to move everything forward. It's not an end. It's supposed to, right? A heckle should start something.
Yeah, it's not just a loud insult that draws attention to the heckler. It's something that is meant to wake up the performer to the potentialities that performer is evidently ignorant of.
Yeah.
When's the last time you guys were each heckled?
That's such a good question.
Been too long.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because Will, I didn't know Clark's little brother, but my friends all did at Northwestern, and he was known to be a genius heckler. He was supposed to be the best heckler ever. And it's funny, that's so true with the heckling thing, because it used to just be a part of it. You know what I mean? Like just that the heckle, especially kind of on the indie rock scene, punky do it DIY shows. It's just like that would happen a lot more. And I'm trying to think of a good heckle. Going back to Portland, I remember there was a guy who kept on telling us that we needed to have more bat wing in our, this is one of the weirdest hecklers. The guy would stand up in front and he'd say something. I'd be like, "What?" And I'd be like, "What?" And I'd have to lean down and be like, "You need to get more bat wing in your sound." And it just kept on going on. And the guy was like really weirdly dressed. And I think maybe the punchline was this, maybe at the end he had bats drawn all over his jacket or something like that. He was just some guy who's obsessed with bats. That was one of the weirder ones where he was very publicly letting me know something, but he wasn't letting the rest of the audience know, you know?
Yeah.
More bat wing.
I remember a story, and we should ask Brett Ralph about it. Josh, Brett Ralph long played music in Louisville, and now he runs a great used record and bookstore called Surface Noise. And he has a story about seeing Pavement and being unhappy with the show for some reason, and being near the front, and there was maybe a slow number, emotional number, and Malcolm had his eyes closed from performing, and Brett Ralph was so upset about what he was witnessing that he just stood directly in front of Malcolmus with his two raised middle fingers, you know, about 4 feet from.
Oh yes.
But Malcolmus's eyes were closed during the whole song. Yeah. And so he didn't. So it was just, it was a joint performance then. It was a collaborative performance.
I know that Clark's little brother, his big heckle was play the good one.
Play the good one. Yeah, that's a good one. I think we have time for just one more, like two songs in.
Yeah.
Well, that's sort of the other question. What's the guide to receiving a heckle? I mean, you know, this seems like an opportunity.
It's an opportunity, exactly. Like, you should.
It's improv.
You should be present. Yeah, it's improv.
Yeah, it's got to be. It's an improv thing, I would say. I mean, like a heckle is an invitation to improvise, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And to check yourself.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And yeah, to check yourself, to be aware of the audience, and something that's exciting in the moment.
Well, this has truly been the conversation that's given and given. As we start to wind things down, I just want to give you guys sort of an open floor to, if there's anything about this record or this upcoming series of shows that you want to get out there that you feel like needs to be expressed, I'd love to hear your sort of final thoughts on like this next step for Superwolves.
Emmett Kelly is a motherfucker. Emmett Kelly is a real motherfucker. If you want to go see a really good guitar player, go to the Superwolves show. Because Emmett's a beast. I guess that's all I got to say.
Essentially, with Matt and with both Matt Sweeney and David Pajo on the stage, there's no telling how many Zwan covers we're going to pull off over the course of the
set. My God.
We're going to surprise all of the deep Zwan fans with.
Me and Pajo have been trading our Billy Corgan demo tapes, and we're getting Will's been practicing his voice, and it's going to be sick.
No, I'm doing Jimmy Chamberlain, and Emmett's doing.
Oh, right.
Corgan.
Oh yeah, Emmett's doing too. Yeah.
So Matt, and confirm, deny, Zwan reunion. Is that something we should mark in our calendars, or what's happening there?
That's what we're going to be doing in upstate New York.
Every Super Bowl show really is a Zwan reunion show.
Okay, that does it for this episode of the WAMC News Podcast. Thanks to Josh Landes for that interview, and thanks to you for listening. Until next time, I'm Ian Pickus.